This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. U.S. President Joe Biden in Poland, after his lightning trip to Ukraine, has declared that there are, quote, hard and bitter days ahead in fighting off Russia's invasion. But he pledged on Tuesday the United States and its allies will never waver in their support as the war enters its second year.
The Ukrainian people's love for their country will prevail. Democracies of the world will stand guard over freedom today, tomorrow, and forever.
A day after his surprise trip to Kyiv, Biden gave a major speech in Warsaw and met with the presidents of Poland and Moldova. Russian President Vladimir Putin has railed against the West in a speech which is thought that may shed light on how the Kremlin sees its so-called special military operation in Ukraine and set the tone for the year ahead. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Putin started his State of the Nation address by justifying his invasion of his neighbor by accusing Western countries of threatening Russia. Russia's president said a year ago, in order to protect people on our historical lands, to ensure the security of our country, to eliminate the threat that came from the neo-Nazi regime that developed in Ukraine after the 2014 coup, it was decided to conduct a special military operation, and step by step, we will carefully and consistently solve the tasks before us. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The United Nations human rights chief on Tuesday voiced concern over a proposed overhaul of Israel's judicial system, saying it would, quote, drastically undermine the ability of the judiciary to uphold human rights and the rule of law. Israel's parliament is pushing ahead with changes promoted by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's religious nationalist government. This is VOA News. At least six people were killed in the latest earthquake to strike the border region of Turkey and Syria, authorities said on Tuesday, 2 weeks after a massive tremor killed more than 47,000 people and damaged or destroyed hundreds of thousands of homes. Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony reports.
A familiar sense of terror was felt by those on the Turkey-Syria border as the ground began to shake beneath their feet for the third time in a fortnight. Around half a dozen people were killed in the latest earthquake to strike the area, authorities said on Tuesday. The disaster hit in the southern Turkish province of Hatay. The 6.4 magnitude quake occurred on Monday near Antakya and was felt in Syria, Egypt, and Lebanon. Turkey's disaster and emergency management authorities said it was followed by 90 aftershocks.
Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony. Mexico's ex-public security chief is convicted in a U.S. drug case, the AP's Lisa Dwyer reports.
A U.S. jury has convicted a former Mexican presidential cabinet member, Genaro García Luna, of taking massive bribes to protect drug cartels he was tasked with combating. He is the highest-ranking current or former Mexican official ever to be tried in the United States. García Luna headed Mexico's federal police and then was its top security official from 2006 to 2012. A roster of ex-smugglers and former Mexican officials testified that García Luna took millions of dollars in cartel cash. He faces at least 20 years and as much as life in prison at his sentencing. He has denied the claims, and his legal team says they plan to appeal. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is taking charge of the cleanup in a toxic train derailment in the mid-eastern state of Ohio, the AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The Norfolk Southern train derailment has upended the lives of people in East Palestine, Ohio. EPA Administrator Michael Regan says Norfolk Southern must take all available measures to clean up contaminated air and water and reimburse the federal government for a new program to provide cleaning services for impacted residents and businesses. If they don't do it, the EPA will step in.
Conduct the work ourselves and then force Norfolk Southern to pay triple in cost according to the powers granted by my agency.
Regan says he knows the order cannot undo the nightmare that families in East Palestine have been living with. I'm Ed Donahue.
The United States could bar tens of thousands of migrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border from claiming asylum under a proposal unveiled on Tuesday that would be the most wide-ranging attempt yet by U.S. President Joe Biden's administration to deter people from crossing the border without authorization. Way News.
Thank you. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. vows to stand by Ukraine as Russia suspends participation in new nuclear arms treaty.
Well, I just come from a visit to Kyiv, and I can report Kyiv stands strong. Kyiv stands proud, it stands tall, and most important, it stands free.
U.S. First Lady begins African tour with a focus on women's empowerment and children issues.
She will also visit Namibia, the first U.S. First Lady to do so since the nation gained independence 3 decades ago. In addition to focusing on women and children, the First Lady will also draw attention to the dire food insecurity gnawing at East Africa.
And years of war in Somalia takes a mental toll on millions of its citizens. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday says Ukraine stands strong a year after the Russian invasion and that Moscow would never defeat its neighbor. Biden was speaking at Warsaw's Royal Castle in Poland hours after the Kremlin suspended a landmark nuclear arms control treaty over the West's support for Kyiv. Days ahead of the first anniversary of the February 24th invasion, Biden proclaimed, quote, unwavering, unquote, support for Kyiv and a commitment to bolstering NATO's eastern flank facing Russia, while rejecting Moscow's contention that the West was planning to attack Russia.
Well, I just come from a visit to Kyiv, and I can report Kyiv stands strong. Kyiv stands proud, it stands tall, and most important, it stands free. He thought he'd get the Finlandization of NATO. Instead, he got the NATOization of Finland and Sweden. He thought NATO would fracture and divide. Instead, NATO is more united and more unified than ever before. Appetites of the autocrat cannot be appeased. They must be opposed. Autocrats only understand one word. No, no, no. No, you will not take my country. No, you will not take my freedom. No, you will not take my future. And I'll repeat tonight what I said last year in the same place. A dictator bent on rebuilding an empire will never be able to ease the people's love of liberty. Brutality will never grind down the will of the free. And Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia. Never. They've committed depravities, crimes against humanity, without shame or compunction. They've targeted civilians with death and destruction, used rape as a weapon of war, stolen Ukrainian children in an attempt to steal Ukraine's future, bomb train stations, maternity hospitals, schools, and orphanages. No one can turn away their eyes from the atrocities Russia is committing against the Ukrainian people. It's abhorrent. It's abhorrent. So tonight, I speak once more to the people of Russia. The United States and the nations of Europe do not seek to control or destroy Russia. The West was not plotting to attack Russia, as Putin said today. And millions of Russian citizens who only want to live in peace with their neighbors are not the enemy. This war is never a necessity. It's a tragedy.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden. The U.N. Human Rights Monitoring Group in Ukraine reports more than 8,000 civilians have been killed and 13,200 injured, including hundreds of children, since Russia invaded Ukraine in February of last year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN officials say that nearly a year into the war, there's no indication that the ordeal will end soon. They warn that Ukraine's civilian population will likely be forced to endure more suffering and devastation. The head of the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission, Matilda Bogner, says the figures gathered by her team are lower than the actual numbers. This, she says, is due to limited information and lack of access to key areas of Ukraine, such as Mariupol. Despite this, she says, her team continues to gather information from witnesses and survivors.
My colleagues interviewed a former prisoner of war who was from Mariupol. And he was forced in Mariupol to collect bodies on the city's streets. He told us that Russian soldiers were expected to meet a daily quota of one truck of corpses per day. And that, as he said, in Mariupol, meeting the quota was not a problem at all.
Bogner says the UN monitoring mission also has documented a wide range of violations of international human rights law. These include summary executions, torture and ill treatment, sexual violence, and forced disappearances and arbitrary detention. She notes the monitoring mission conducts human rights investigations, but is not a criminal investigative body.
The information that we collect is useful for international prosecutions, both in terms of showing patterns of violations that are taking place. Also, in some cases, the individual cases that we document can be of interest to international prosecutors, to international tribunals.
The report finds that explosive weapons have caused the most casualties in Ukraine and that attacks on critical infrastructure intensified after October 10th. Russian attacks on Ukraine's power infrastructure have left major cities without power or running water. The UN monitoring mission has information regarding 160 civilian casualties, including 30 deaths in the territory of the Russian Federation. Since this information cannot be corroborated, these figures have not been included in the numbers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The European Union is marking the anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine with more sanctions against Moscow. Previous sanctions have targeted commodities like oil, gas, coal, steel, cigarette, vodka, and gold. But one key Russian export is expected to be off the EU's list once again, diamonds. For VOA, Lisa Bryant went to the world's diamond trading capital of Antwerp, Belgium, to find out why.
This historic city seems far away from the battlefields in Ukraine, but it's linked to the conflict through Russian diamonds. Nearly all rough diamonds imported into the European Union arrive here. A quarter or more usually come from Russia. Ukraine has long pushed for sanctioning Russian diamonds, which it says help finance Moscow's war machine. In the crosshairs is diamond powerhouse Alrosa, partly owned by the Russian government. Last year, Washington and London put sanctions on Russian diamond imports, but not the EU. Some lawmakers are pushing to change that. That includes Kathleen Van Bremt, a Belgian European Parliament member from Antwerp.
The Antwerp diamond sector used to be a front runner in getting rid of the blood diamonds. It's very important that the Antwerp diamond sector remains a front runner in getting rid of these diamonds, because Russian diamonds are also blood diamonds.
But Antwerp's diamond industry argues that sanctioning Russian diamonds could cost thousands of jobs, and it would simply export the problem. Tom Nays is spokesperson for the Antwerp World Diamond Center.
If they don't get sold here, they will get sold somewhere else. And they will get sold in trade hubs where you do not have the regulations against anti-money laundering, where you do not have the regulations against the financing of terrorism, which we have the strictest in the world here right in Antwerp.
Antwerp's mayor also opposes banning Russian diamond imports. His office did not respond to VOA interview requests. But there's one area where politicians and Antwerp's industry appear to agree: establishing an international system to trace and track Russian diamonds across borders. Reports say the EU and the Group of Seven Nations are discussing how that could work. Philippe Regnier, director of the International Peace Information Service Research Group, believes it's doable, but there are caveats.
We think it's possible, but it will require a lot of coordination and a lot of technical thinking. And the question is, who would be on board? How inclusive it would be? Because there's a big risk, of course, that big diamond players would not want to be part of that.
Van Bremt's office has been tracking Russian diamond exports and the ways Moscow appears to be circumventing U.S. sanctions and those of other nations. But the lawmaker still believes EU sanctions are important, along with the foolproof tracking system, to keep Antwerp's reputation as an ethical diamond center intact. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Antwerp, Belgium.
Thank you, Lisa. And the countries of Southeast Asia have long maintained a fragile balance between resisting China's expansive claims in the South China Sea and maintaining good trade ties. But several, including Indonesia, are now standing firm in resisting those claims, as VOA's Ahadian Utama reports from Jakarta.
Indonesia has approved an initial plan for the development of the Tuna Block gas field located in waters off its Natuna Islands. It's the same area where drilling in late 2021 led to a protest from China. Jakarta halted exploration then, but it isn't backing down now. Natuna Islands themselves, off the coast of Indonesia's Borneo, are Indonesian territory. But the waters about 200 miles away, where the Tuna Block is situated in the North Natuna Sea, is a source of contention. Indonesia considers it also parts of its exclusive economic zone, based on the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS. But China includes it in its expansive territorial claims in the South China Sea, claims largely rejected by the Permanent Courts of Arbitration at The Hague in 2016.
Regarding Indonesia's activities in its national sea area, it's based on the international maritime law, and Indonesia's position is that we do not have a dispute with any country that claimed the South China Sea territory.
The resumptions of gas exploration could be seen as an escalation of tension between Southeast Asia's largest nation and China. In December, tensions were already high when Indonesia and Vietnam finalized the boundaries of their exclusive economic zones, prompting Beijing to send its coast guard near the Tuna Block and Vietnam's nearby Chim Sao gas field. That move led Indonesia to send a warship to the North Natuna Sea. The Indonesian Navy has now deployed 5 warships and a naval patrol plane to monitor the North Natuna Sea, which, like many waters in the Indo-Pacific, has also seen fishing activity from Chinese vessels accompanied by the country's coast guard. From Jakarta, Indonesia, Aharyan Utama, VOA News.
In other news, the French Pasteur Institute announced on Monday that a third person has been cured of HIV thanks to a bone marrow transplant. The unnamed patient living with HIV, who was being treated for leukemia in Dusseldorf, received a bone marrow transplant from a donor exhibiting a rare stem cell mutation, making them resistant to HIV. Potential surviving infected stem cells then found themselves unable to infect others with the virus, thanks to the donor's naturally HIV-resistant cells. The case, quote, Dusseldorf patient, unquote, comes as the third worldwide, with a previous case in 2007, the Berlin patient, and another in 2016, quote, the London patient. More than 39 million people worldwide are currently infected with HIV, and the AIDS pandemic has killed about 40 million people since it began in the 1980s. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Joe Biden leaves Tuesday for her first visit to Africa as First Lady, with plans to visit the Southwest African nation of Namibia and the East African nation of Kenya. There she will focus on women's empowerment, children issues, and the food insecurity that has ravaged parts of the continent. VOA's Anita Powell, who is traveling with the First Lady, reports from Washington.
Joe Biden visited Africa 5 times as Second Lady, highlighting the plight of the powerless. Here she spoke at the continent's largest refugee camp in Dadaab, Kenya, in 2011.
The mothers are bringing their children from Somalia, walking sometimes 15, 20, 25 days, and they lose their children along the way. The children die. So what I'm asking is for Americans just to maybe reach out and help, and because the situation here is dire.
Now First Lady, she returns to Kenya this week. She will also visit Namibia, the first U.S. First Lady to do so since the nation gained independence 3 decades ago. In addition to focusing on women and children, the First Lady will also draw attention to the dire food insecurity that is again gnawing at East Africa. In December, President Biden announced a $2 billion humanitarian package to combat the problem in the region.
Assistance is going to help ensure that children and families don't have to go to bed hungry.
Presidential spouse visits often provide a contrast to the strategic, muscular approach of the presidency. Partly because, as Jill Biden herself points out, she has no executive authority and no mandate from American voters.
I know that I wasn't elected, but I knew that I had a part to play. And as spouses, we serve the people of our countries too, don't we? And we see their hearts and their hopes. We witness the small miracles of compassion and generosity between neighbors. We know what can happen when communities come together and how much can change when we work towards a cause that's really so much bigger than ourselves.
U.S. First Ladies are generally well received on the African continent, said Catherine Jellison, a professor of U.S. Women's History and Gender History at Ohio University. Maybe because they have an advantage over the president.
There's just going to be warmer feelings toward a non-politician who's visiting than a politician, because there may be strings attached.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration has been wooing Africa to support Ukraine over Russia and recently dispatched Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen to Senegal, Zambia, and South Africa. And Russia's foreign minister has this year visited multiple nations that have historic or ideological ties to Russia or the former Soviet Union, like Mali, Sudan, and Angola. China sent its new foreign minister to Africa for his maiden voyage, a sign of that nation's deep interest in the continent. First Lady's visit opens Wednesday and is expected to last 5 days. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
According to a health study by the UN and Somali organizations, decades of violence and humanitarian crisis have left many Somali people traumatized. Harun Maruf reported from Washington, and Abdul Qadir Zubair in Mogadishu spoke to mental health doctors and patients in the country and has this report narrated by Salim Solomon.
Abdurrahman Dahir Gutale often brings a family member to the mental health center. He says his relative's health deteriorated and he suddenly turned violent. The family is worried he could possibly harm others and sought help. The fact that Gutale's family sought help is rare in a country where discussing mental health issues is often seen as taboo. Dr. Liban Muhammad Omar, who runs the center, says there are cultural norms that make treatment difficult. In most cases, loved ones speak for the patients through relatives out of respect. But the most difficult hurdle is the perception of the problem.
There is stigma. People are too reserved to talk to you honestly about their condition. Therefore, stigma exacerbates the condition.
The Gutale family story is not an isolated case. As a result of over 30 years of war, Somalis have wounds both visible and invisible. A first ever epidemiological study on mental health in the country, the study says nearly 77% of the population in Somalia has a mental or psychological disorder, higher than previous studies had suggested. The study by the UN, Somalia's health ministry, and the National University found that the prevalence of mental disorders among the young is significantly higher. Malik called on the community to reach out for help and treat those suffering with compassion. Lack of awareness also plays a part, Omar says.
The majority of patients have little or no knowledge about mental health illnesses. Now, we are increasing our efforts toward creating awareness of mental health.
As for the Gutale family, they say their efforts are paying off.
We started seeing a change when he received treatment. He slept after a long time and became calm. It allowed for his caretakers to get some breaks, and he's now on his way to recovery.
The study conducted between October 25 and November 15, 2021, also recommended training frontline healthcare workers, increasing awareness, and routine screening for mental disorders at the primary healthcare level. For Abdul Qadir Zubair and Harun Maruf, Salim Solomon, VOA News.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
It really was powerful because it showed what is possible when men and women band together and say enough is enough.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation. Each week, right here on The Voice of America, on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Next up, we mark the anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russia has failed to conquer Ukraine and to divide the NATO and transatlantic alliance. U.S. President Joe Biden demonstrated U.S. and Western resolve in standing with Ukraine with his historic wartime visit on Monday, assessing the state of play in Russia and Ukraine with two of the foremost regional analysts. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Around the clock, The Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-minute VOA newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and issues in the news on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedofo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Diplomacy is the only way to definitively end Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine and to create a path to peace that is both just and durable, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken, quoting Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Clearly, President Vladimir Putin has no genuine interest in diplomacy right now, he said.
Here's what he said just a few weeks ago. Unless and until Ukraine accepts the new territorial realities, in quotation marks, there is nothing to even talk about. In other words, Ukraine and the world must somehow acquiesce to President Putin's land grab. That should be a non-starter for every country in the world that cares about the UN Charter and preserving international peace and security.
Clearly, nearly 1 year into Putin's brutal war against Ukraine, it's critical the United States and its allies and partners maintain and increase support for Ukraine, said Secretary Blinken. We've calibrated our assistance to meet Ukraine's changing needs from the outset of the Russian invasion, and that's exactly what we'll continue to do.
In total, the United States has committed nearly $30 billion since the beginning of Russia's invasion, and our allies and partners have provided more than $13 billion in military assistance over the past year and tens of billions more in humanitarian and economic support. The contributions that Europe writ large has made to this effort are very significant and making a profound difference.
This is the time to double down, to help Ukraine prove to Vladimir Putin that with the sustained help of its partners, Ukraine will not go down in defeat to his war machine, and that the only way out of this conflict is through diplomacy. This is already evident from the fact that Putin's war continues to be a strategic failure, said Secretary Blinken.
He's failed to overthrow the democratically elected government of Ukraine. He's failed to subsume Ukraine into Russia or to break the will of its people. He's lost the battles for Kyiv, for Kharkiv, for Kherson. His military is suffering staggering losses on the battlefield, and he's failed to weaken our alliance and what it stands for.
The best way to hasten prospects for real diplomacy is to keep tilting the battlefield in Ukraine's favor, said Secretary Blinken. This will help ensure Ukraine has the strongest possible hand to play at a negotiating table when one emerges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.